I just clicked on one of the suggestions there, which was build me Elon Musk's Twitter profile.
You just had to bring him up, didn't you?
Welcome to GCP Bytes, episode number 15 for Friday, the 25th of April, 2025. GCP Bytes is a podcast where we discuss Google Cloud and tech. And I'm your host, Stephen Bancroft. On today's show, I'm back, baby, back in the hot seat. Broadcom make a giant backflip. IBM make a new mainframe. A mainframe? And AWS finally joins the AI party. But before we get to any of that, I'd like to introduce the co-host of the show, Dave Wall. How are you, Dave?
I'm great, mate, and I'm glad to have you back with us.
too much pressure.
It was on.
And our very own GDE, Ian Brown. How are you, buddy?
I'm good, mate. How are you doing?
Good.
Welcome back.
Yes, I'm glad to be back. Although you guys have essentially put this show together. Like I was still in the throes of travel twilight on Tuesday when I didn't quite make last meeting. But you guys did a great job, and I was able to sit there on the cruise ship, overlooking the water in the little library there, and just edit the show with a nice coffee in my hand. It was great. Yeah, it was very easy to do.
It would have been an interesting experience for you this time around, because you, when you were listening to our audio recordings, was the first time you would have heard us. So yeah. Hot off the presses.
Yeah.
Going, what are these idiots talking about?
Dump that audio.
Yeah.
Half of it's on the cutting room floor. You only had to do the intro three times. I think that's fine.
Yeah. It's a rookie numbers. We're going to pump them numbers up.
the change of format to the show, that was really part of that's one of the reasons I wanted to do it, right? Like when we started this show, well, in this previous incantation, 4 years ago now, I have, other than our scheduled breaks, I have not missed an episode. So I wanted to be able to have it built into the structure where I can, if I need to have a little break, you know, and I think it worked just fine.
It's dedication of the utmost level.
Yeah. We're a highly available podcast, you know. We've got
highly available.
Two nodes and a witness.
Yep.
Nearly 100 episodes now between the two, and I've sat on all of them, and I've had to edit all of them as well. So there's a lot of work there, and hence the fortnightly schedule, right? If it was weekly, it's just a no. No go.
Good times.
All right, thanks for that, guys. Really good to be able to know that you're capable. That's good. I've got a good team.
Capable might be a stretch.
I mean, culpable, but
yeah, well, culpable, yes.
And in the meantime, Dave, do I hear some barking in the background?
Yeah. We picked up a new little golden retriever puppy last night. Oh. So we had our first night with him last night. That's little Ralph.
And Ralph is such a cool dog name.
Morning, Frank. Morning, Ralph. he's a happy little fellow. But he was a little sad last night. But, you know, first night's always rough with a new pup.
Well, my German Shepherd's got into our chook yards and got one of my chooks yesterday. So, there's always that. And what's this? Did you throw this in here, Ian?
Oh, the Google chat history update.
Yeah.
So, and you might have noticed it in our chat, actually. There's a banner up the top of our group chat.
There is.
But Google sent an email saying, you know, we're right into an upcoming change of how conversation history is saved. Today, when you save chat conversation from a personal Google account to someone who's using chat for school or work, you'll see the entire conversation history. Mm-hmm. But come the 1st of May, that is going to change. After that date, work or school accounts will control the deletion of messages for conversations started by their users. So,
yeah, right. So if you're participating, like, I mean, like you guys, right? So we're using my account. I don't get that banner because I'm already managing it as a business account. So yeah, I guess it's if you're in a business's account, you will be bound to their retention policy.
That's right. Yeah. So and it and it doesn't just apply to new conversations; it is new and existing conversations.
Right. Okay.
So there you go.
A bit of standardizing.
Yep.
Yeah, chat's one of those things. It keeps developing, right? Like I'm surprised that they seem to be going the opposite way of what they normally do. I don't think it's very popular, but they haven't binned it yet. They seem to actually keep developing it.
Yeah, I mean, have to admit, is like I'm really enjoying the current iteration of chat. You know, we've used it for a few years now. Back when it was only a web app or in the side of my Gmail, I didn't like using it. It was very strange. Yeah. But actually having like an installed app and I can treat it like I used to treat Slack. I like that. I wish I could put some party parrots in there, but
yeah, that'd be nice. I mean, come on, Google, we need custom emoji.
Say that, but you can do that on a fully internal chat. All right, so internal Hive one, I've got a party parrot emoji loaded, but I can't do it in the one that I've got with you guys.
Oh, that's again still disappointing.
Yeah. But, I mean, at least, you know, like Google Chat's hanging around, but country-specific top-level domains going the way of the dodo.
Yeah. They are very much so.
So no more google.com.au?
Yeah. So, and this is an interesting take because, so I was testing this out the other day because they say that, you know, that google.com provides you with country-specific search.
Because it knows where you're coming from. And, yeah.
And so what I did was I went to google.com and I did a search for something that I search for fairly regularly. And then I went to google.com.au and I turned on the search only Australia, did the same search, and they're entirely different.
Yeah.
So like the standard google.com was searching across the world and most of the results were international, not local to where I am. So even though they might say that it's like you're going to get the same experience, you're not.
Yeah, I agree because, you know, like, and I can see why. Because just because we're in Australia, like sometimes we do want worldwide stuff. Hmm. But if I want a barber, I want the one that's down the street.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So if I search for so I live in a town called Flaxton. If I search for something in Flaxton, there is a Flaxton in the US. There's a Flaxton in New South Wales. Mm. There's a number of towns called Flaxton. So I get results from all of those and not necessarily the ones where I am, which is pointless because I'm not traveling to the US to go to the post office.
Yeah. So, I mean, well, it's interesting in the sort of CNET article about it because they're like, well, you know, this is a legacy thing. It's very, you know, web dot, you know, version one kind of way of doing things, having, you know, top level domains to actually manage your results. But yeah, I agree. Like sometimes I actually wanted I wanted to drill down to just Australia stuff. Right.
So I think, and they're talking about like your web search settings and all that sort of stuff in the article. And I did have a look through the web search settings, and the only way I could set search to be Australia only is go into the advanced search section.
Yep.
And whereas once upon a time it used to be an option in the toolbar, just like tools, Australia only.
Yeah, if I'm in .com.au, then I can have like the worldwide or Australia. It's just like it's right there. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. So it would be good if they added that to google.com. And says, well, we can detect that you're in Australia via your IP address. So give the option to say, I only want Australia results.
Or at least if I'm signed in, then give me you know where I am.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
No, you are, yeah. So there is the site colon trick and it'll search domains that have AU in it, for instance. So you do site colon AU.
Yep.
But, you know, that's not necessarily always the case though, right?
That's right, yeah. Lots of the sites that we have in Australia are .coms as well that serve predominantly Australian stuff.
Yeah. On my band, for instance, I've got .band.
Yep.
Yeah. All right, well, we're going to do it anyway, so there's only so much bitching we can do about it. So.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Come on, Google,
a lot of bitching.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, tilting at windmills. But, besides all of that, has anyone had any tech adventures the last fortnight?
Ooh, I have. So, Proxmox have released a new bit of kit called Proxmox Data Center Manager.
Ah, yes.
So, right.
The vCenter alternative.
Yeah. So, well, yes and no. So, it is a way of managing multiple Proxmox nodes without having to make them a cluster. So, it's a single pane of glass. So, if you've got, a previous job that I was in, I was managing 20 offices around the country worth of VMware hypervisors, and there might be three hypervisors in each office. So I'd have to have a vSphere cluster for each of them, and then I could add them into the vSphere main panel, right? Proxmox, you could never do that. It was like you could have this cluster, and then you could go to that cluster and manage it. In Zen Center, if you want to do that, you could like add the individual nodes into Zen Center and pseudo cluster them. But it wasn't a simple process where they call it PDM. So Proxmox Data Center Manager, it allows you to add individual nodes into there and manage them all from a single interface, yeah. Which is really cool. Still in alpha.
That's been a, it's been a bizarre shortfall from Proxmox for a long time. So it's great that it's coming, even if it's in alpha now, for 15 years or something. It's been like, why is there not a single pane of glass for this?
Yeah, that's right.
Because people were just been using it at home, and the home lab's up to now, right? And you probably only have one. There's not the need for it. Suddenly there's an urgent need for it, right?
They have been selling Proxmox Enterprise subscriptions, right? Like they had business customers. So like surely there's a value.
Maybe those business customers didn't have, multiple different data center workloads. So maybe they only had that single cluster that they were licensing and not having, like, for me, I had two different data centers I was managing, as well as the 20 offices around the country, and all of them had different environments. So it would have been nice to have something like this right from the get-go, as opposed to having to license vSphere on everything.
Yep.
Because that's costly. Not as costly as it is now, but it was still costly.
Yeah, right. So so you've got that set up and that's all working well for you in alpha?
In alpha, yep. Yeah, no, it works a treat. I cannot get over how good it functions.
And Banky, so, I mean, while you've been away and you've been on a cruise for all this time.
I have, yes.
Cruise ships being, very keen implementers of Starlink. How was the internet?
So, yeah, I did use the Starlink internet while I was on the cruise. In fact, what I did too is I was able to take a Shadow pocket router with me.
Oh, nice.
And I connected that to the ship's Wi-Fi, and when we were back in the room, everyone was able to have Wi-Fi.
Right, so nice. You only had to pay for one access.
Only had to pay for one access. And that worked okay, I guess. There was a bit of a problem where I couldn't put my finger on it, but I think because we were in the room and we were kind of midway between two access points, I think it kept flipping between the two access points and we would occasionally lose connectivity. But it was strange because when we were in port, the problem, there didn't seem to be a problem. It seemed to be much more reliable. So I never quite put my finger on exactly what that was. But other than that, it worked fine. And then obviously in the day when I did the edit, I just took it and re-registered it on my laptop because I didn't want the kids stealing any of the bandwidth. But no, look, it was good. You know, I was able to sit in our cabin and consume all the Donald Trump news that was flooding the social media, and that get my daily dopamine fix. But other than that, you know, you do something like that to get away from all that, right? Like, sitting by the pool, I got through a number of books, and, when we were out on tour, you get off the ship and do a tour, local tour. We went to Bali. I was just using local roaming, which I had data switched off, so I didn't want to have. I didn't need the internet all the time, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I didn't want the internet all the time either, because I was, you know, the intention there is get away from it. But when I did need it, it was there. Yeah.
Oh, very good.
But they're all using Starlink now. Just the way it is.
Yep.
All right. Well, with that having been said, let's get on with the community news.
Missed your professional segues, mate. I just
slides it on in there.
Yeah. And once again, with our very own GDE on board, you've gone through and put in a number of events here. Ian, take us through it.
Oh, mate, there's so many going on. So the Build with AI events are still happening around the country. So GDG Brisbane has their Build with AI event on. That's on the 2nd of May. 5:30 PM. At the precinct at the Wara Room, I think it's called, and launch event space. So get along to that one if you can. There'll be details for all of this. GDG Sydney has got a meetup in May. It's showing now as sold out. It wasn't showing that yesterday or the day before when I put it in. So sadly, that's on 7th of May at 5:30. You might still be able to get on a waitlist for it if you register now.
Yeah, that will be at the Mantle Group office. So, you know,
that's right.
If you happen to be in there, maybe working on that day, you could probably just go in anyway and have a look.
Yeah. Rock up and gate crash. GDG Melbourne, these guys put on so many events. So they've got their Build with AI workshop. Again, it's in the Mantle Group, Mantle Group office in Flinders Street in Melbourne, April 28th at 6 PM. And then they've got another one. They've got the International Women's Day 2025 event. That's April 30th at 6:30 PM. Again, it's in the Mantle Group office. GDG Adelaide. I haven't seen anything from these guys for a little while, but they've got their Build with AI event on at the Core Innovation Hub in Adelaide on Frome Road. That will be the 7th of May at 5:45. And Darwin. These guys are just kicking off their community, and they're doing a fantastic job of it too. So they've got a Build with AI event at the Oaks, Darwin, the Oaks Hotel in Darwin City.
Speaking of Darwin, Ian, we went to Darwin on my cruise, and we need to get up there and do the military tour. You can get on a Willy's Jeep, and they take you around to all the embedments and then a couple of museums and stuff. Yeah.
Yes, I've been to the artillery or the naval gun museum that's up there, and I have a photo of my hand in front of the muzzle of one of those naval guns, and oh my goodness, they are huge.
Big boys, big boys. Yes. Yeah.
So Darwin, 7th of May, 6 PM at the Oaks Hotel in Darwin City. And last but not least is GDG Perth. They've got their Build Your Own AI-Powered Learning Assistant with Gemini. That will be on the 9th of May at 7:30 PM, and it's at Mia Yalagonga in Perth CBD. That's it.
Wow. Well, that was a mouthful. There's quite a lot there, and pretty pleased to see. Mantle Group is, we're taking our fair share there. There's quite a bit going on in our offices.
Yep.
So if you want to get down and check out the Mantle Group and the Mantle Group offices, this is a perfect time to do it as well.
But they've always been really good with offering up their workspaces for Google events and AWS events and Azure events, I'm sure. But certainly very good for all the GDG communities out there to host an event.
Yeah, well, we've got the space there, and you know, it aligns quite nicely with what we're doing. So, and in fact, the Sydney one, I see that Anu's talking at the Sydney one. Yep. I pleased to say that I did work with Anu a little bit when he was at the former CASNA, and yeah, very bright guy, and I'm sure his talk will be very entertaining. All right, then. Links in the show notes. Go check it out. Let's get on with the news items. Broadcom, told ya, told ya.
Like, oops, wait a minute.
Oops, we did it again.
Yeah, VMware revives its free ESXi hypervisor in an utterly obscure way.
So the current release of version 8 update 3E, ESXi Hypervisor is now free again.
Yay.
Again.
So this is the entry level, but not vSphere and you know, personal use and all that kind of stuff. But it means you can spin up your labs.
And I feel a but coming on here that's like a however, you need
need to have an account.
Yeah.
Yeah, you need an account, and it's to go and find it is quite difficult. You've got to bounce through a few things and actually get to it. You know, it's dumb. They took it away. So we had the VMUG user, right? And I was a member of that, right? And with that, you get 12 months licenses that you can use on all the stack, and you can set up your lab. And as long as it's $200 to get a membership. As long as you remember, you can maintain those eval licenses. It took all that away. What am I going to do now? And I got no lab. How are people meant to learn this stuff?
Yeah. Right? But it's not even just like learning at home. Like how often in our professional context, you're like, oh, I need to test out something. All right, I'll just quickly spin up a lab. I don't want to go pay for a real license. It's like, I've just got to spin up a lab, do this implementation, test a few things out, and then blow it away.
Yeah. And do you think Broadcom, well, they're a hardware chip manufacturer, right? Do you think they missed the point on that?
Oh, 100% they missed it. It went clean over their heads.
Yeah.
It was one of those things. I mean, you guys have probably had this as well. In various occupations that I've had where I've been working in VMware's environment, I'd have spare servers sitting there that I could run up labs on if I needed to. Like, I need to do this upgrade from this version to this version. Let's do it on the lab first so that if it breaks, it's just a lab.
Yeah,
I'm not doing it on my production gear.
I can write up my change plan on it, and then when at 2 o'clock in the morning when I'm doing it, I know the steps I'm doing are going to work, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I can do the firmware upgrades on all the machines, and then I can do the VMware upgrade on the machines, and off I go. But that's all gone.
Mm.
Yeah, and considering that all of the competitors, right, so Nutanix, Platform 9 now has a free edition, Harvester's got the free edition.
Yep.
Even Proxmox.
Especially Proxmox. Paying for Proxmox is the rare occurrence.
Well, and Zen Server's got free editions as well, and that is a really polished system now that so it's been sort of Zen Server is the community sort of, or Zen is the community project hypervisor, and then Zen Cloud Platform is their sort of vSphere style thing. And it is like fully web-based and has been for years, and a really polished system as well. So all of these guys offer free versions.
I mean, even Hyper-V technically, like, because you can stand it up and it'll run without a key. Like, it'll just say, you know, you'll get a little splash saying that, you know, it's not going to run. But
you can't customize anything on the OS unless you register the OS with Microsoft. But you could technically run Windows Server in eval mode for 180 days, so 6 months. And, you know, in 6 months' time, I mean, it's a lab.
Yeah.
In 6 months' time, blow it away and recreate it.
So
and you can automate that, right?
Yeah, well, for sure, right? But, you know, we're not talking about running any production stuff. And, yeah, I think Broadcom's like, oh, actually, wait a minute. Even though we only care about the enterprise, you know, you know, Fortune 500 customers now, those customers still sometimes just need to spin up a lab.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, so it is, and I do have a Broadcom account because, you know, I had a VMware account and I moved it over to Broadcom. And I did go and try and find the version of ESXi to download. And you're right, Banky, it is insanely difficult to find. It did just jumping through hoops left, right, and center to try and find it. They're constantly trying to push you to a subscription.
That's right. And there are a couple other articles floating around that give you the instructions on how to step through to find it. Go and check it out. I'll have to. My licenses are still valid from my VMUG subscription, so I'm not about to go and blow away my machines. If you need to spin up at ESXi Labs, is the way to go. Mm.
Yep.
But in more positive news, it's sounding like they may be quietly rolling back that minimum core count shift from 72 cores back to 16. So, you know, that's something that we touched on last fortnight, that was a massive cost increase for a lot of people. So
absolutely, yeah.
That was just insane. It really was. That was, we were covering that and I'm like, you can imagine small business that are trying to use this gear and going, oh, you need to license 72 cores. I don't care if you've only got 16, you need to license 72 per machine.
Yeah. So, hopefully that's going to play out.
Yeah.
All right, and speaking of VMware, ATO, they're not getting out of it. ATO bundles Broadcom-owned licenses into single $109 million deal.
Yeah, this one I found the other day in the IT News emails. Now, because Broadcom owns CA's...
That was Computer Associates, software. Wasn't it?
Yeah,
it's
CA mainframe.
Yeah,
because you know the ATO runs a mainframe, and they've just upgraded to the later IBM Z16 platform, which is it's not the latest platform that IBM's created.
No, but we'll touch on that one later.
Reasonably new. Yeah, but they use CA mainframe software on it, right? That contract was $69 million. Right, for the agreement for the year, and then they had a $28.6 million deal with VMware that went out to January 2026. Now I did the numbers on that, and that's only like $97 million, $97.5 million. So I was trying to work out where the extra $10 million came from, and I really can't find it. Like, the article doesn't go into much detail.
Not much there, no.
No. What they're saying is that they're expecting to save something around the $32 million mark in licensing between 2024 and 2025 in outsourcing. So I can't really find where the extra $10 or $12 million has come from, only to suggest that maybe with the increased license costs in Broadcom's version of VMware, that you know maybe that's where that licensing
extra. So they're taking an extra $10 million in VMware licensing to buy themselves an extra, looks like about 18 months worth of license length.
No, it's actually not even that. So it actually extends the contract out to January 2026. And it's the extra for the VMware side of things is an extra $65,000 just in VMware licensing for the extra couple of months that they were going to be out.
Right. But I guess the point is they were able, because Broadcom owns both CA and VMware, they were able to bundle the license costs together. Your hard-earned tax dollars at work right there. Perhaps Elon Musk should have taken the chainsaw to VMware licensing. That probably would have worked out better.
Would it? Would it have worked out better?
No.
As a, It couldn't have worked out any worse than it possibly is for him right now.
Hold my ketamine.
Speaking of Doge and cuts and things, CVE fallout, the splintering of the standard vulnerability tracking system has begun. So, as we know, the Common Vulnerability Exposure CVE program, which was run by the US government, you guys talked about it last fortnight, has been discontinued. Yeah. They've discontinued the funding from MITRE that runs the CVE program. And, of course, there's the European agency have got an equivalent one, and there's some open source ones as well. You know, I'm surprised that there's not been an open source version of this, you know, a high quality open source version of this anyway. It's the kind of thing that should be run by the open source community, not held, you know, in trust to the US government, because this is what happens.
Or the EU government.
Yeah.
Yeah. I suppose the problem is, right, is if you start getting an open source thing, even if it was in, say, like the CNCF or, you know, Linux Foundation or whatever, is that because the money for it has to come from private enterprise, right? You'd be like, okay, well, we're going to get donations from Broadcom and Google and all this stuff to help fund the service. You know, there would be a concern, or there can be a concern of like, well, what if, you know, we get some pressure to not list one of our CVEs? Yeah, it's that the appearance of whether or not things will show in.
Yeah, if it's an open source database, then there is the ability there for big players like the Microsofts and the Broadcoms to go, no, you're not going to put this information in there because that makes us look bad.
Yeah, we'll pull our funding. Yeah, I think that's the concern. And up until recently, you know, it was working pretty well. We've got this, you know, this is a service that's put out. You know, we're working in a world of what seemed to be fairly rational actors, and now we are not in that world.
I did have to have a little bit of a chuckle because I was reading through the article. There's another global system for identifying and numbering security flaws, which is the Global CVE Allocation System, or GCVE.
Yeah, that stuck out to me as well.
Yeah, but I like the comment that it seems like it's actually just run by like one developer.
Yeah.
So maybe that's not the one that we get behind.
Yeah.
And the article does go on to say, to me, this is a quote from Brian Martin, who is a Flashpoint vulnerability analyst, says, to me, it signals a global lack of trust in the US government's commitment to ensuring the continuity of CVE. And look, that comment there, global lack of trust in the US government, I mean, we're seeing that everywhere at the moment, right? It's not just in CVEs, unfortunately.
So I was reading Defence News the other day, and there's, I think, two or three articles that I've seen in Defence News of late about how we in Australia need to become more self-reliant on our own defence and not reliant on the US, because the US is no longer a reliable partner.
Yeah, we absolutely do.
Yeah.
So,
and we're not the only economy in the world that's you know, picking up what's been put down either. Yep. So it's a global trend at the moment. Yeah. So the other problem, I guess, with it is it's a single point of failure, as it's been demonstrated here. Right. I take a quote from the article. There's also a new CVE Foundation, a not-for-profit formed to bring the CVE program under its auspices and eliminate a single point of failure in a vulnerability management ecosystem. So I get the single point of failure, but then don't we just end up with like two names for the same thing if we have two systems?
Yeah, like, and that's what we've got now, right? Yeah, the EU's got their own system, which actually stores the CVE managed identifier as well as the, I think they call it GSD ID or something.
It's just another column in the DB.
They're the same thing. So, yeah, global security database ID. So there's now two. So if you're using the EU, the Euro database, there's two identifiers that you can use to correlate a vulnerability.
We keep our vulnerabilities in metric now. So
yeah, that's right. No more measuring in bananas.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
I don't know. I like the hacker names: Cozy Bear, Midnight Blizzard, Apt 29. Yep. You know, Famous Sparrow.
Yeah.
All right. So yeah, let's. There's ups and downs at the moment. There's backflips all over the place. So let's see what happens with this one. We could get off the call today and then suddenly find it's been funded again.
So it has. They've actually put up another 11 months worth of funding for it. So at least it's not going to be switched off tomorrow.
Yeah. It'll be February next year.
Yeah.
Right. All right, so sure. All right, well, we've still got plenty of CVE reporting ahead of us. That's good to know.
Yeah.
All right, let's move on with some Google news. Firebase Studio.
Oh, this is so cool.
This is cool. I went and had a little bit of a look. You get it for free, Ian, but I have to pay for it. The developer premium program, yeah. And you can get it, you can spin up a few apps. You get like 20 apps for free or something in this. And I went and had a bit of a click through and had a look. Whoa. It's like, where do I start with all of this? This is cool.
It's pretty cool. Yeah. So that IDE that you're using is Project IDX.
Yeah.
That's had a whole heap of plugins built into it, which is Project IDX really is just a fork of OSS code, which is like VS Code's core software.
Yep.
But the open source version of it, I think it's called VS Codeium, if it's not the Microsoft branded version. OSS Code in Google's world has become Project IDX, and then that has now become Firebase Studio.
And dang it, if I didn't say it a few episodes ago, IDX needs to be integrated with Gemini, and here we have it.
It is. It is Gemini integrated. It is full stack, so you can develop your front end and your back end and your rags and your agents and all that sort of stuff. You can add VS Code plugins into it through the OpenVSX registry. It allows you to deploy directly to Google's infrastructure right there from inside.
Yeah, it's just one button deploy, just bop.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And when you go in, you get a Gemini prompt there and it says, what would you like to build? And then it comes up with some examples. And it's like, oh, I could just type this plain text in and it'll just make it for me. It was a bit overwhelming. Yeah. It's like, oh, is that easy?
Yeah, and then, it runs up, kind of like a much more advanced version of, I think it was about two podcasts ago, we were talking about Gemini with Canvas and how you could just like spin up these web apps and that was really funky. Mm. This is just like the big boy pants version of this. And so the apps run up and then you can click on parts of the interface and you go like, actually, I just want to change this bit here. Like, can you do this? I want to make this purple or, squircle off these edges for me, and it just does it.
It's fully integrated. Yeah.
Generates test data and everything.
We're talking about vibe coding.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I was like, what the hell is vibe coding?
This, baby. This is vibe coding.
Well, I heard about vibe coding when I was doing the edit for the first time last fortnight.
Yeah, nice.
And since
I'm glad
then,
I'm not the only one.
I've had multiple like shorts and things come up and mention vibe coding, and I'm like, yeah, I'm cool. I'm down with the kids. I know what this is all about.
Yeah.
I like when you commented in our group chat about it. He goes, I don't know, vibe coding, this kind of just seems like shit to me. But now, like, 2 weeks so you're like, I think I need to do me some vibe coding.
Yeah. So really, really cool innovation there from Google to actually turn Project IDX, which I felt was sort of floundering a little bit in that, it was a thing that was out there. It was really, really cool, but virtually no one knew about it. And those who did know about it didn't really use it in anger. So, and now you've got Google's like, well, we're going to bring this in. We're going to add a whole heap of really cool stuff to it, and we're going to make it Firebase Studio.
What I'm seeing is that Google has finally, okay, you know how if you're a Google Workspace customer, right? Mm. You can use all of the various tools, and it's a very holistic way. You know, you can use docs and sheets and chat and email, and everything kind of works, and Drive is sitting in the background, and all your files are in Drive, and it's all integrated, and so it works really nicely. And Google's got so many great tools that for a long time didn't directly talk to each other, right? Yeah, and IDX is one of these, right? So okay, we've got IDX, and we've got Gemini, and we're going to host everything on Firebase, so you can have Firestore storage, and you've got infinite scaling and all these sort of wonderful things. Pull it all together and make it super user-friendly, right? You don't have to do anything like weird in Vertex AI and digging into creating like a Google Cloud tenant and project, and you know, which for some people is still, you know, that's a whole milestone that you need to get over. This makes it just crazy easy.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It is really cool. And yeah, you're right. The whole setting up an IDE, like this, where I work, there is an actual document on how to set up your IDE and how to import like the coding standards and how to import the, you know, all of this stuff that you have to do in order to set up your IDE so that it works in the environment that you're coding in. Whereas this is just there. It applies the standards for that language and off you go.
Yep. And, you know, for so many people, especially people who don't have a development background, right? Mm. Like I can do some coding. I'm not a developer, right? Like no. So for me to go like, I want to make a to-do list app, right? The old little boilerplate one. I have to sit down for a moment and go, okay, wait, what do I have to do? Because I don't do this day to day. All right, I better go and, you know, I have to do a little bit of research.
Yeah, what framework am I going
to
use?
Well, yeah, correct. Blah, blah, blah. Do people still use React, or do I have to switch to something else? Like, yeah. So exactly. So it's a whole thing. And you know, and you get to people who are significantly less technical than I am. It's like, well, where do you start? I'm like, tell you what, Firebase Studio, give it a crack.
Yeah, exactly. And then it does really cool things like, in your Firebase app hosting, it will detect if you've got a secret stored in your code somewhere that, you know, could be getting exploited. And Google will, if you have a service account key or some sort of key stored in your code, Google will proactively disable that key so that it can't be used by external parties. So, you know, the security is there. It's not just a, hey, come and use this really cool thing that's got absolutely no security surrounding it, because, you know, no one's ever been burnt by that before.
Hey, look, you've got an open bucket.
Yeah. And we're storing invoices in that bucket.
So, yeah, no, it's very cool, and I think everyone should give it a go. And you don't even need to actually deploy to Firebase if you don't want to. You can actually just use it to create a bunch of code and then deploy it on your own infra. Like,
yep. Copy the code and use it this way. Yep.
So, yeah, it's very, very cool.
Excellent. I do have a couple of things I want to build, but once again, it's just a matter of getting the time, right?
Indeed.
All right. Well, let's move on to we're going to get on the next, but just before we do that, we'll talk about just quickly Woolies. Woolies, they're saying they're going to continue on Google Cloud.
Yeah, they've renewed their agreement with Google Cloud to extend for another
5 years.
5 years?
Yeah.
5 years.
Was it 5 years? Yeah. Mm-hmm. So Woolies has renewed their agreement with Google Cloud as their technology partner again for another 5 years. So yeah, we look forward to seeing how many resources they can consume there.
All right, well, let's get on to the big news. And it completely happened while I was away.
You missed out. Like, it was just, for us, it was great. We had so much content.
Absolutely, yeah. Next 25, of course, was on. I haven't even watched the keynote. Usually I'm all in on this, but what did you guys see of it?
You were sitting on a cruise ship when we were recording and things were dropping as we were recording.
While we're sitting there, we're like, we'll just... pause for a moment, go watch some things.
Yeah, I had a few things that I wasn't allowed to release until like the morning of, And we started recording the podcast last fortnight, and it was like, right, I'm allowed to talk about this and this and this and this and this now. So, yeah.
Of course, straight off the bat, a bunch of new models. And some of this stuff we've actually covered during the year, right? And that's what Next typically tends to be. It's like a, yeah, there's some new stuff being released, but they're also sort of rolling up stuff that's happened during the year. And, of course, all the models, Gemini 2.5, of course, is out, Imogen 3, Chirp 3, Lyria, yep. Enterprise Ready, text-to-music modal, model, VO2, and Meta Llamas 4 is generally available in Vertex. So all in on the AI.
Yeah, I'm still waiting for VO2 to be enabled in my Gemini. Apparently they're rolling that out kind of every day so more people get access. So I still don't have access to it just yet in Gemini. But
that's the video generation. I guess I just don't want everything to be hammered at the same time.
Yeah, that's right. They need to let it scale.
Yeah.
So one of the ones that I found interesting, like, yeah, okay, there's a whole heap of AI stuff and a whole heap of Gemini Code Assist tools and Gemini Cloud Assist and everything prefixed with Gemini has been updated. One of the ones that I found really, really good from a financial management thing was the FinOps Hub 2. So now includes waste insights and cost optimization opportunities from Gemini Cloud Assist. So, you know, again, integrating Gemini into FinOps so that you can keep your cost down and your application running.
Yeah, and so and actually getting those insights like brought up to you and not having to dig into, you know, billing and things on your own.
Yeah, I shouldn't have to go through every single project in my org in order to find, you know, this machine has been over-provisioned and I could save $400 a month on it because, you know, that happens.
Yeah, that does. It does.
Yeah.
And, you know, $400 doesn't seem like much, but you do that 10 times.
Yep.
And suddenly it's a big bill, right?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I think for me is one of the ones that really stood out, and it's related to your FinOps one, was how Application Design Center, which also uses Cloud Assist, now has Gemini in it. So you can natural language, just chat away, go, oh, I'm kind of wanting to build this app. What kind of services can I use? And it gives you a couple of nice things. One being your architecture diagram, right, for all these different services showing how everything pulls together. But it also gives you the Terraform to stand all that stuff up.
Yep.
Like,
how good
is that?
Yeah. How good.
Yeah, exactly. Here's another one, Banky. You might, well, all three of us will love this. Nutanix cloud clusters on Bare Metal. So they're available in public preview.
Right.
So Bare Metal cloud infrastructure running Nutanix hybrid cloud.
Maybe we're going to be getting down to a GCVE Nutanix kind of thing.
Yeah, well, I mean, GCVE uses off-the-shelf hardware, so it's using Dell hardware. Is certainly last time I saw it was. But this is using Google's Bare Metal nodes. So these are their custom hardware that it's using, and it's giving you all the same Nutanix services, like your DB as a service and your file objects and your AI and Kates and all the rest of it.
Yeah, so that comes along with the new C4 shape machines as well. C4 DVM, C4 VMs, C4 titanium, C4 bare metal. So you get 288V CPUs and 2.2 terabyte of high performance DDR5. It would not surprise me if they're sitting on those.
Yeah, more than likely. Another one. You know, that this will come as no surprise that GCVE has evolved once again. 18 additional node shapes.
Yes.
So the total between V1 and V2 node shapes is now 26.
Yeah, I was perusing that list yesterday. Like, there are so many different options now. Now you can get like a whole bunch of nodes that have got 2 terabytes of memory on them, which, we've had problems with that in the past.
And storage-only nodes.
And storage-only nodes that you don't have to do any kind of weird bespoke way of managing. It's just right off the bat.
Right out of the gate. That's it. I also had on my list here networking, 400 gigabits interconnect now, and cross-cloud interconnect. Also cloud WAN, which we discussed, and the next-gen firewall has new network types and layer 7 domain filtering as well. So all very nice.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, it was certainly there was certainly a lot of things released. I think there was 280 odd releases or something? Something crazy like that. It was 240 releases. It was huge.
That's right. The list I'll link in the show notes. I'm just scrolling to get to the
231.
It's quite long. 231 items, yeah. That includes a bunch of new partners as well that they're partnering with, partner announcements, and some security partners as well. I'm going to have to go and see if anyone's done a little AI soundbite because we need a new one.
Yep.
All right. Well, getting over the hangover of Next, Google has got a few little worries on its plate. Google is a monopoly. Yeah. So says a US federal court judge, and some people are sniffing around for Chrome.
Yeah, so I mean they've been pinged on their this is the ad network stuff. This is that monopoly, that trial. So yeah, that's definitely come through now.
Yeah. So the U.S. District Judge Leonie Brinkema in Alexandria found that Google's liable for willfully acquiring and maintaining monopoly power in markets for publishers, ad servers, and market for ad exchanges, which sits between buyers and sellers. So you have too much power. And the outcome of that is so that decision clears the way for another hearing to determine what Google must do to restore competitions in those markets, such as sell off parts of his business at another trial that has yet to be scheduled. So it is determined that, yes, you are too much powerful, but exactly what they have to do is yet to be determined. The article goes on to say, this is an article on iTunes News, a judge in Washington will hold a trial next week on the judge's request to make Google sell its Chrome browser and take other measures to end its dominance in online search. Could be the end of an era.
It could well be, and there's a couple of companies that are vying for first place when it comes to purchasing Chrome.
Yeah, Sam Altman's OpenAI is very keen to pick up Chrome. but Perplexity Chief Business Officer Dmitry Shevelenko said he didn't want to testify at the trial because he didn't want to, you know, kind of run afoul of Google. But he did say that, like, well, if Chrome had to be sold, Perplexity would buy it, but they would prefer that Google kept it than OpenAI get it. Like, Google's AI models are advancing so rapidly now because they've got so much access, like their video models, because, you know, you've got all of YouTube that you can mine, right? And you can do that on the back end if you're Google. And, you know, having the browser as a way to actually, you know, not only do we point you to our right search engines, but we can put you to Gemini versus anyone else. Like, yes, you've got all that control. And OpenAI would love to have that, right? They would love to make the default of Chrome to start to point to all of OpenAI services.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. But I think they'll find that a lot of people would stop using a lot of that stuff. If it changed hands, people would become skeptical as to whether... Like, I would be. I would definitely be skeptical if it was going to continue its reliability and all the rest of it. Yeah, I know that Chrome shifts so much of my data into Google to index for ads to send to me, but, you know, I'm aware of it and I ignore it.
It's a good browser, right? Yeah. So, but yeah, I mean, I think for me, if Chrome changed hands, I'd be dumping it in a heartbeat and going back to Firefox.
But the thing is that there's so much, like, yes, there will be people who would do that, but you've got, for so many people, they're like, oh, well, yeah, but Chrome's the browser I use, so I don't really care who runs it in the background, or they don't think about it. So the vast majority would continue, I imagine.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, I guess I'm thinking of it from my position as a, you know, my daily driver for my work is a Linux machine, and the first thing I usually do after installing a new Linux machine is put Chrome on it.
Yeah. Yep.
Right, but I can just eliminate that step. 9 times out of 10, Firefox is installed on any distribution. Yeah. Why don't I just continue to just stay with Firefox, right?
And Thunderbird.
And Thunderbird, yeah, that's right. And I use Thunderbird. But there's better... no, I'm not going to say better. There's other Edge. Browsers out there that are better than Edge. Firefox. Well, yeah, you could, but no. There's other browsers out there that are better than Firefox, but maybe not quite as good as Chrome at speed of browsing and all that sort of stuff. Chrome does a lot of prefetch stuff to make your web browsing experience feel seamless.
Snappy and smooth.
Yeah, that's right. Firefox is a little bit lax on that. It's not anywhere near as good. And quite often I find, especially when using GCP, I've got, like, if you had a look at my work profile in Chrome, you would see like 30 different GCP tabs open, console tabs open, because I'm working in all these different projects all day. And I find quite often that the browser crashes those tabs. Mm. Or they're really slow to respond, or, you know, there's a whole heap of things that happen there. So I don't think Firefox is quite up to the spec that Chrome is. There are others out there that probably are better, but...
And where does this leave Chromium?
Well, this is the thing. So Chromium is developed primarily by Google. As the open source version, so it doesn't have all of their kit in it, but mm-hmm. it's also the base of what Edge uses for its browser.
Yes.
So,
hence I asked the question.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So I wonder whether if Google is forced to sell off Chrome, whether they stop developing on Chromium altogether and fork it and make their own new browser.
Right,
Google's new Chrome.
Yeah, so we could
Chrome
we
Classic.
Could yeah, yeah.
So that's interesting because at the moment we've basically got a two horse race between Firefox and Chrome. Could we potentially see if it was fork? Then I mean, it's reasonable to say we've got a three horse race at that point.
It wouldn't surprise me if we saw. If Google was forced to sell it off, I wouldn't be surprised to see Google fork the current Chromium base to a closed source browser that they develop themselves, that they don't release the code for at all, and they stop developing on Chromium and start developing a new browser entirely. I think that I could see that happening. Whether right. it does and or then- not, I don't know, but I could see it happening.
And then how long do you give Chrome and, like, they'll just end up crushing that browser,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah,
like
exactly.
This is the thing, yeah.
Yeah. It'll be a case of Google will put code into their Google, like, accounts like Google.com and Gmail.com and all the rest of the platforms to go, hey, if this is Chrome, slow the experience right down.
If, like, it's our new browser, then, you get all these whiz-bang features.
Well, I mean, Microsoft does that. Well, they did that with Chrome.
Yep. Well, Silverlight's a famous example of that, right? Oh, you don't have Silverlight? Well, you're not going to get all these features.
Yeah.
Going back to the 90s. All right.
Excuse me, I just need to go and update QuickTime, RealPlayer, and Flash.
Hey, I still got Winamp installed on my machine.
I was just about to say, don't forget to install Winamp.
All right. Well, let's see how that plays out. Let's get on with a bit of security news. One security story this week, and it comes from our old friends at Microsoft. Western Sydney Uni SSO system breached, quite possibly due to 365 authentication issues.
Yeah, it looks like when I had a look at all of their systems, it all looked like Microsoft 365 SSO. So you can only sort of – it doesn't say it in the article. All it says is in the article is that it affects the data of some 10,000 current and former students after an unspecified single sign-on system was breached. Now, the only single sign-on system I could see when I browsed the WSU site was Microsoft 365. Everything led to Microsoft 365. So, you know, you can only infer from that that's the system that was hacked. I don't know, like, to be honest, I don't know what they're going to do to fix it, because it doesn't sound like it's their system to fix. Maybe it's their implementation that's broken. I don't know. But yeah, I mean, that comes as another really high profile hack that happened just in the last week or so. So you guys all remember 4chan, don't you?
Yeah. The heart of the internet.
The heart of the, message boards back in the day. Yeah. Back in the days, it was it's an image board technically, but yeah. You know, it got hacked maybe a week ago now, and the hackers purportedly had root level access to the entire platform. They brought back one of the deleted message boards, and just put this big banner across the top of it. It's like, you got hacked. And so 4chan has been down ever since. Like, it's offline completely.
Yep. You go to the everyone's 4chan email addresses. Apparently a lot of, like, you know, .gov email addresses.
You go to the 4chan.org site at the moment, you just get a 503 returned.
Yeah. But there's still r/4chan. So, you know.
The unfortunate problem is with 4chan gone, that was quarantining a whole bunch of terrible people into one bulletin board. Right, yeah. Where have they gone? I'm sure they're out there.
Now they're at sojack.party. Sorry, I've already been down this rabbit hole all week. Looking at, like, righto, so what else is there now that 4chan's gone? What's the... And apparently the story goes on the message boards around the internet that it was actually one of the Soyjack guys that hacked it, who was ex-4chan or something, or was one of the ex-4chan admins or something like that, wasn't removed properly. Jumped in, brought the channel back, put "you got hacked" across the top of it, and had a bit of lulls about it.
Jeez.
Now you can go to r/4chan, you can get 4chan and toxic Reddit content at the same time.
That's exactly right. That's
fantastic. So anyway, a slight diversion there, but yep. The university intends to start notifying affected individuals next week. It said that once the breach was detected, it worked with its internal cyber team and third-party resources to shut down the perpetrator's access in real time. In other words, they probably changed a few passwords.
Yeah.
The university said it was also investigating a dark web forum post from November that appeared to contain personal information from the university community. So this individual may have been in there for a while. And
that's usually the way it goes, though.
The way it goes, yeah. And if it is an Office 365 issue, who's to say that others haven't been affected and are currently don't know about it?
Unaware, yep.
Mm. All right, then. With Securitas out of the way, let's get on with the AI Wars.
AI Wars.
AI Wars.
Good to have the three of us on that.
Yeah.
Loved it.
more power. And mainframes. It's all been about mainframes. I thought, you know, what are we programming for Fortran in the 70s?
Mate, sometimes you still need big iron. Right?
You still need big iron. IBM Z17. The first mainframe fully engineered for the AI age.
Yeah, and I think this is the first time on our cloud podcast where we get to actually talk about a mainframe system. But, man, like, these are still running the core of financial institutions, because
you just need a
big old database, right, that can just...
And a VT200 terminal. They're all set.
Green screens. That's all we need.
But so I was really surprised that there's so many businesses that still run mainframes. There's so many banks and insurance providers and all the, and like the ATO, obviously, we covered that earlier, that still run a mainframe.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
does my head in that we're in 2025. And I mean, mainframes were a thing of the past in the 2000s, the early 2000s.
Yeah, I mean, I worked, I wasn't directly on the project, but I did help a little bit on a, not the scale of these are the Z series, which are the high-end mainframes, but I worked for an enterprise that had the I series systems. So I series replaced AS400s, which was running like JD Edwards. It's like an ancient ERP. I don't know if you can. Yeah. I don't know if anyone's. I'm sure there are companies that still are running JDE, but certainly, you know, it's a lot, SAP has replaced a lot of those. But yeah, these ones now. This is the Z17. This is the big boy.
Right. Yeah, that's right. So apparently, it's built. So a bit of marketing spiel here, because we do like marketing spiel. IBM Z is built to redefine AI at scale, positioning enterprises to score 100% of their transactions in real time. And it's got a little one above it. It says the claim since the introduction of the IBM Z16 in 2022, which is the one that ATO has just upgraded to, the IBM Z mainframes have been able to support AI inferencing directly in the mainframe, making it score 100% of real-time transactions, even in high-volume production environments, which I said, I didn't even think mainframes were still a thing, but apparently they are, and they're coming ahead leaps and bounds.
Yeah. And this is all achieved by this IBM Spire accelerator, which is to be available in Q4 2025. It's a PCIe card, and it has the Telum II processor. And the Spire accelerator is specifically engineered to bring generative AI capabilities to the mainframe, including running assistance. Like, what? Yep. Why are we having Gen AI on a mainframe? What the hell is this dystopian universe?
More mainframe-y things.
More mainframe-y things. Well, you need to do inference across, you know, well, the data that I'm reading on here is that this this Z17 system can do 450 billion inference operations a day. Right, so that's across all your transactions. Like the big one that they're keen on is like targeting this at credit cards, right? So being able to do like the credit card fraud detection in real time, right? Because those transactions come through straight away, and if you can within 1 millisecond go, nah, that's a fraudulent thing. Well, you can bounce that back. Without ever having it come all the way through and have to do a chargeback and, you know, that whole process.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that was going to be my question. What is the use case? And you've just highlighted it perfectly. Yeah, yeah. If you can do that in real time, absolutely.
Yeah. 450 billion inferences operations in one day with a 1 millisecond response time, that's insane.
Yeah, so I'm sure that these are going to be on their way to the core of, you know, Visa and Amex and...
Yeah, yeah, and lots of banks will go back to you, and I'm surprised that they haven't, given what I've read of these mainframes now. I'm surprised that they haven't gone back to using mainframes. I know there are still a couple of banks that I'm aware of that still do use mainframes. They're not interested in moving off them. I know an insurance company that has a mainframe, and, you know, whilst they're probably looking at migrating away from the mainframe, it's going to be a costly exercise and probably not worth the money.
Yeah.
Well, I'm just thinking at a technical level as well. Like, if you want the millisecond response that Dave was just talking about, cloud may not cut it, right? Like, you're processing these things in real time. By the time you push it up to the cloud, wait for the scaling to happen, you're processing it on some shared GPU, blah, 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 and then it comes back to you. I mean, how many transactions can you push through on a fraudulent credit card in that time?
Yeah, that's right.
Right? But if you can shut it down, you know, nigh instantly, then they're going to much prefer that, right?
Yeah.
So. Yeah. And so just as another thing, just a little bit of nostalgia, did everybody see the reference to IBM's Watson X in there?
No, I did not.
Yeah.
So the Z17 apparently is designed to bolster the skills and efficiency of developers and IT operations with the use of AI assistants and AI agents, right? Including IBM Watson X code assistant for Zed and IBM Watson X assistant for Zed.
Maybe part of it is that, okay, well, we need to make these systems easier to use because you're not going to get new grads, right? Yeah. New developers that are like, oh, yes, I've definitely been training and I'm super keen to work on a mainframe application.
You'd be surprised how many developers actually go and try and learn RPG code, which is what the IBM mainframes are using for the most part is RPG.
Or Pascal.
It could be Pascal or COBOL or if they're COBOL. Older mainframes, yeah. But I know at least the IBM I series are using RPG for a lot of stuff. And it's actually like I did a bit of reading on it when I first was exposed to it. And it's actually a reasonably intuitive language to learn.
I suppose if you've got that and you're willing to work on those code bases, it could be quite lucrative.
Yeah, the deployment process isn't, we'll say, intuitive, but the actual code itself is reasonably simple to learn.
Right. And, I mean, nice thing on these new systems is that at least for secrets management, because IBM has HashiCorp, it now has Vault. So,
yep.
Yeah, there is, even in the mainframe world, we're starting to get some DevOps tooling.
Yeah, phenomenal bits of kit, though. When you look at the size of them and how many processors they've got and all that sort of stuff, they are pretty interesting bits of kit.
Yeah. I'm not going to go into the rabbit hole of what makes a mainframe a mainframe. Maybe we can follow that up in a later episode. But
a mainframe podcast now.
Yeah.
Speaking of
mainframe bytes.
Speaking of big computers, NVIDIA, we will build an entire AI supercomputer in the US with partners. NVIDIA says we'll build an AI supercomputer in the US, despite all the tariffs, I guess, for the first time, thanks to investors, it's making with Taiwanese manufacturer partners TSMC, Foxconn, and Wistron. Now, what's going to make this supercomputer? It doesn't go into the technical details on it, does it?
Well, no, saying that this is actually supercomputer production. It's not just a single one. It is actually, so it's obviously going to be TSMC going and standing up chip fabs. That, from what I understand, they will not be the latest, latest manufacturing nodes because Taiwan will not let those leave the country. But certainly on previous, step nodes. And then obviously you got Foxconn for everything that they build, right? From physical, chassis to motherboards and, same goes for Winstron. So.
Yeah. Well, they've already got manufacturing plants, so TSMC has already got a fabrication plant in Phoenix in Arizona. Mm. And then Foxconn is standing up manufacturing in Houston and Wistron in Dallas. So, they're talking 12 to 15 months here before they're ready to produce stuff. But it's they're trying to get around the tariffs that the U.S. administration has placed on imports.
But they're not going to have the 3-nanometer or 5-nanometer stuff, right? Like that's
it's very unlikely,
which is pretty much anything that's worthwhile at the moment, right? Like let's not go down that rabbit hole, but that's going to be very difficult for the US to overcome, I think. Cool. And speaking of chip building, AWS finally, they've come to the party. They weigh in on the whole AI hubbub, and they're going to build some of their own AI chips. This is an article from CRN. Andy Jassy, chips are the biggest culprit in expensive AI. AWS will fix it.
Yeah.
He's going to fix it all up. The AI does not have to be expensive as it is today. Interesting. And it won't be the future. Chips are the biggest culprit, says Jassy in his annual letter to shareholders this month. I would have thought it'd be power.
Well, yeah. I would think so too.
Apparently, it's not the power, right?
But yeah, look, that Jazzy's AWS is trying very desperately here to play catch up. I think on the whole AI. I think they looked at it right at the very beginning and went, eh, "This is a fad. It's going to go away," much like computers did in the 80s.
well, like Amazon does have pretty good like chip chops, if you will.
Yeah.
Like because they had for a long time, you know, you could run their specific CPU, like ARM-based CPUs.
Yeah, they had the first Graviton? Cloud.
What was that?
Graviton? Google. Yeah, that sounds about right. Because they had the first ARM-based CPU available in the cloud.
Yeah, which then, you know, has pushed a lot of demand for, you know, for a lot of Linux applications to then, you know, have the ARM binaries and everything. So, you know, it's been great. I suppose this is more them realizing that they're sick and tired of paying NVIDIA.
Exactly.
Google's got their TPUs, like the Ironwood TPUs, which have just come out, which are phenomenal. So I think Amazon's like, well, okay, we're going to need to actually the compute side of things is fine. We need to start on either a TPU alternative or a GPU alternative.
Exactly. And Jazzy goes on to say, most AI to date has been built on one chip provider, i.e. NVIDIA. It's pricey, he says, and Trainium chips, this is what they're proposing they're going to build, should help, as our new Trainium 2 chips offer 30% to 40% better price performance than the current GPU-powered compute instances generally available today.
So, and I'm not sure. So, I'm not sure how that then compares to the Ironwood TPUs that Google's produced, because you know Google's saying that those are like 100% better than the previous generation.
Yeah, it's a very different thing, right?
At what cost?
Yeah.
I don't think he's saying they're going to be more performant, but I think what he's saying is, you know, that the price to performance ratio is going to be better.
Yeah, but he's comparing it to GPUs.
Yeah, not TPUs. Yeah.
Not TPUs. Yeah. And what I'm trying to figure out is how does that compare to like say Google's Ironwood. TPU.
I suppose he doesn't compare that because they can't get access to them. Google don't sell TPUs, right? You can't buy one. So, you know, like...
He's only got the NVIDIA GPUs to compare it to.
Yeah,
that's true.
Yeah, so actually that could be a good inference as to how good the TPUs are, is to compare them both to the same, like, NVIDIA H100 or something.
Yeah, well, I think the big thing with the TPU stuff, especially with Ironwood, is that it scales so astronomically. It was like 8,000 nodes or something. Like, it's just enormous.
Especially if you run it on a 65,000 node Kubernetes cluster, like we do, like we covered a few weeks ago. Astronomical.
So that's winning. But Amazon, you know, don't want to be paying these fees, and they'll do it themselves.
Yep.
Well, I mean, a little bit more competition in the market is going to be good. A bit of an alternative technology, if it's a little bit, you know, just running your basic models might be good for that. If it's using less power and it's a bit cheaper, why not? Why not indeed?
Exactly.
All right, and then finally, to finish off the AI wars, we have Gemini 2.5 flash release.
Yeah, so that's just come out like last couple of days.
Yeah.
All right, so we've had 2.5 Pro, our wonderful thinking model out there, you know, kicking everyone's ass.
Yeah.
2.5 flash is out now, and you can toggle whether or not you want it to have it to, you know, do its thinking and reasoning modes. It's certainly a lot quicker. Running down that mode and going to be cheaper to run. But it looks like there's a bunch of other very interesting models coming soon.
Now, this link you put here in the show notes, I'd not seen this before. WebDev Arena leaderboard.
Yeah, I hadn't either, and that's why I put it in there, because I was like, what?
A real-time AI coding competition.
Yeah.
Yep.
And it updates it in real time. This is cool.
This got surfaced to me because I saw it pop up on the Bard subreddit. the Bard subreddit being the Gemini one, right? And because there are some Google models that are appearing on this leaderboard that are not yet released.
Yeah.
Now, we are talking about Flash here. That comes in at number 7. Gemini 2.5 Flash Preview comes in at number 7. Gemini 2.5 Pro is coming in equal second with ChatGPT 4.1. And but that top of the stack is Claude 3.7.
That's the Gemini 2.5 Pro that they've got in here is an experimental version from March. So...
Yeah, so what's happening is this leaderboard, things are moving up, right? So some of these older models like Claude 3.5 is a couple of months older. So, yes, it is higher up on the leaderboard, but it's been around for a bit longer. So, yeah, there's a few that are popping up there. The ones that seem very interesting appear to be early checkpoints of what could potentially be Google's 2.5 Pro Coder models, right? So, you know, we've talked about vibe coding a whole bunch, which you can do some wonderful things with Gemini 2.5 Pro, but a specific model for coding. And the code names on these is a couple of different ones. So there's Night Whisper and Day Hush. This came through on the Bard subreddit that the UIs and interfaces that these models are able to produce, like it was producing a like a Pokemon battle, and it, like the amount of data that sort of pulls through, and like it looks like it came from like the Game Boy version. You even got like actual like Pokemon icons and stuff in there, and they're doing their attacks, and you can use it all. So it's real cool seeing with this, you know, develop in such real time. So it's, you know, nothing officially announced from Google there, but definitely keep an eye out.
Yeah, this is really cool. I love this leaderboard. This is fantastic because it gives you links to all the different models that it's testing.
It does, yeah, yeah.
And there's some in there that I had no idea about. Like there's Quen 2.5 Max. It's exploring the intelligence of a large-scale MoE model.
Mm. And DeepSeek's playing the game there as well. They're right up in fifth position.
Yep. Yeah, they've got V3 is in fifth, yeah, and their R1 is in fifth. Having said that, the comparison that I saw, and I think that we went over last episode, Dave, was that of all of these models, DeepSeek actually ranks quite a bit below the latest Gemini model.
Yeah, indeed.
As does Claude on a lot of the benchmarks that they're putting it up against. So, you know, the real world experience on how these different models go might tell an entirely different story from the benchmarks that are put them against.
For sure. I'm actually just in the background here. I've just gone in and I clicked one of the examples on a battle, and I was like, oh, it came up and says like, ask it to create a podcast hosting platform. So I was like, okay, I'll click that. So it's running in the background, and it gives me two different AI models that are both using the same prompt and, you know, going and creating it. And I'm just waiting for it to finish. And then I'll be able to compare which one is better.
Excellent. Well, I highly recommend you go and play with that. It's a little battle link on the left-hand side of the link I'll put in the show notes. But I think that's about it for this fortnight. Been great having a chat with you guys and getting back into the hot seat. Always fun. Don't forget, if you're listening to this show, you can find us on Apple Podcasts as well. You can find us on Spotify and YouTube Music. Go to Apple Podcasts, write us a review, that really helps show out. You can also start the discussion on YouTube, and while you're there, smash that like button and give us a sub as well. That'd really be good. And if you want to do it the old-fashioned way, you can contact the show, contact@gcbbytes.com.au, and you can find us on the web as well, www.gcbbytes.com.au. And I guess if you search in Google, you could use site:au to find us.
You could.
You could. And then today's show, of course, is sponsored by one of our very own hosts, Dave Wall, Hive Tech Solutions. Want to get something 3D printed, go look them up. And, of course, the mob that I work for, Mantle Group. That's about it for us. I guess you got to go and get shoveling the driveway, Ian.
Yeah, mate, clean the pool out and, you know, not how I expected to spend my Anzac Day.
No. I've got to go do an edit, but I might go and get a coffee first.
Yeah, it sounds like a good idea.
I reckon so.
All right, that's it from us. See you later.
Bye.
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 Well, we picked up the puppy yesterday evening, and so he had his first night, and he's in his crate, but, you know, howling away, and then he'd fall asleep, and then like an hour or two later, he'd be howling away.